Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Cochran, Judge Bryan, and Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Theodora Gaetis presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 16th, 2022, and our calendar is being held remotely using the Zoom platform. We have six cases on the calendar this morning, three oral and three non-oral. I see the attorneys are here for our first oral argument of the morning, so we will proceed. The first case on our calendar is A21-1477 in the matter of the Surveillance and Integrity Review Appeal by Nobility Home Healthcare, Inc. And counsel, good morning to you. I just have a few comments before we begin with your arguments. First, I know you're both well aware of the time limits of the oral arguments this morning. Appellant has 15, respondent has 15 minutes, and then appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal. We do have a clock that should be visible to both on the screen that we'll be counting down your time. And I see you both nodded when I mentioned the clock, so I assume you can both see it. We are making a recording of your arguments this morning. It will be an audio-only recording and will be available on the court's website shortly. And then finally, in the interest of that recording, I ask that you please mute yourselves when you're not talking. And with that, we are ready to begin. We will start with counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, and thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. So we're here today because DHS issued a fine of $5,000 and a second fine in the form of an overpayment for $328,788 for the single issue of paperwork errors. Again, as we made clear in our brief, the issue before this court is whether or not internal paperwork documents that have nothing to do with medical services provided, internal paperwork documents that have nothing to do with bills paid, funds received,
they are... Also, can I interrupt you for a second? You said the paperwork errors have nothing to do with the services provided. It's my understanding that some of the... overpayments that were included in the amount of the monetary overpayment recovery amount were for lack of a care plan. And doesn't that relate to the care that's provided?
So let's be clear, it does not. So what the issue is every single person here has a care plan. What the issue was is there was a period of time in which that care plan did not have an updated date on it or some issue like that. Those are paperwork errors. Those care plans are not missing key pieces of information. They're not missing. There's nobody that had zero care plan. Everybody had a care plan.
If the care plan isn't updated, how do we know that the appropriate care is being provided?
Well, let's be clear about this. They were being provided. There's no allegation that they weren't being provided. The witness from DHS testified that she was not aware of any facts to suggest the care provided in this case was anything less than medically necessary, professionally provided, and excellently provided. There's no allegation of any kind that this in any way pertains to any of the actual services provided. So what the allegations were in this case was that the medical care plan had lapsed. There was no allegation that it failed to contain necessary information for care. There's no allegations that they didn't have the medically necessary information. There's no allegation that that some care lacked or was not provided appropriately because of that. And the only witness in this case specifically disavowed that. She testified that after an exhaustive search, investigation, and discussion, she agreed, to the best of her knowledge, medical care was appropriately provided, was necessarily provided. Every hour that was given, every service that was provided was reasonable, was necessary, and was appropriate. Period. That's the evidence in this case. Now, we can speculate based on some potential paperwork error, about whether or not there's some hypothetical circumstances under which conceivably there could theoretically possibly conceivably be some type of impact to care. But those aren't facts. That's complete speculation. That's contrary to the evidence in this case. The evidence in this case is that with the possible exception of $3,700, the rest, the $321,000 plus the $5,000 in fines, was 100% medically necessary, reasonably and perfectly provided. The issues in this case are things like not having an AM and PM on a timesheet. And we need to understand what that is, because there's apparently some confusion from DHS about that. Those internal timesheets are kept by Nobility. They're not submitted for payment. They have nothing to do with the payment process. The issues we're talking about are simply internal record-keeping issues that Nobility uses. The question then becomes, even if there's a theoretic conceivable link between a paperwork imperfection and possible medical care provided, the question becomes, and the question this court needs to answer, is whether or not a paperwork error, an innocent, innocuous, inconsequential paperwork error, constitutes abuse. I would be...
Mr. Watkins, I just want to talk about the sort of categories of errors that that were considered by the ALJ in this case. It seems like, let's take the allegations concerning Ms. B and put those aside for a moment. It seems like there were two other categories of errors relating to the other miscellaneous group of patients, care plan violations and timekeeping violations. And as to the care plan violations, DHS assessed a fine. With regard to the other allegations, which were timekeeping allegations, DHS sought to recover an overpayment. That's sort of my understanding of those categories. I first want to be clear that I'm understanding those categories correctly. And second, I'm wondering if your argument is the same as to both categories of errors.
Sure. So first of all, that's not exactly DHS's position as I understand it. With respect to care plans for Ms. B, they did issue an overpayment for care plans. They did treat them differently. So for Ms. B, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars of care plan violations that they called an overpayment.
Right.
Aside from the $3,000, yeah. In addition to that. So that's different from. So it's not, as I pointed out in my opening brief, they treated care plans differently. With respect to Ms. B, they called it abuse. With respect to everybody else, they called it a paperwork error that constitutes a fine the maximum of $5,000. And that's not the issue with potentially one PCA who was inappropriately billing. Setting that $3,000 issue aside, there's over $100,000 for Ms. B's care plans because the end date was missing. That's the allegation. They had a start date. They lost 1 year, but there was no end date. They called that abuse. So the dichotomy that you're seeing was not consistently applied, first of all. Second of all, our argument is absolutely the same. And of course, it's the same on both contexts from our perspective, because the statute is clear. It talks about record keeping issues. It describes and explains record keeping as being subjected to a fine. The legislature made that determination. Abuse is very different, and it must be different under the statutory framework. You've got two provisions in the statute that deal with record-keeping issues, that explain what happens with record-keeping issues. And the record-keeping requirements for a home health provider, as you would imagine, are incredible. They are onerous. They are strenuous. They cover a lot of ground. And arguably, that's necessary and appropriate. But the contention that any deviation in that issue of any kind, any type of record-keeping error constitutes abuse, is completely contrary to the statute. So in our mind, there is no dichotomy. They have not explained that there's a difference between care plans and timesheets. There's nothing in the statute that explains there's a difference between care plans and timesheets. There's no testimony from the DHS employee that explains how or why there's this dichotomy between timesheets and care plans. That doesn't exist in the record. We have no reason to suspect that they've treated them differently or why they would have treated them differently. There's just simply nothing in the record. There's nothing in the statute. The statute could not be clearer. If there's a record-keeping error, it is a fine, and that fine has a maximum.
Counsel, though, I'm not sure that's exactly right. When you look at the statute as a whole, 256B.064, subdivision 1A talks about sanctions, grounds for sanctions against vendors. I know you're referencing subdivision 2, F, I believe it is, regarding fines. But there is another subdivision, subdivision 1C, grounds for and methods of monetary recovery. So the statute itself makes a distinction between monetary recovery and sanctions and fines.
Okay,
and so it provides that the commissioner may obtain monetary recovery from a vendor who's been improperly paid either as a result of conduct described in subdivision 1A, which is grounds for sanctions, or as a result of a vendor or department error, regardless of whether the error was intentional. So if there's a record-keeping error, subdivision 1C provides for recovery based of the monetary payment.
Okay, so if I can tackle that, first of all, subdivision 1A7 specifically says failure to correct errors in the maintenance of health service or financial records. That's all of them. It makes no distinction between healthcare plans and timesheets. 2F similarly makes no distinction between the two. So I don't see the distinction within the statutory framework. Nothing's been called to our attention. There's no arguments from counsel. There's nothing in evidence to suggest that's what DHS does, to my knowledge. To your point about subdivision 1C, we addressed this in our reply brief. With all due respect, that argument makes no sense to me. I don't understand. DHS made this contention for the first time in its response brief. There's nothing in the record. There's nothing in the allegations. There's nothing of anybody, any DHS witness that said, we made a determination under 1C. Second of all, as you pointed out, 1C talks about mistakes that are the that result in payments. The mistake has to be the cause of the payment. So if somebody makes a mistake that causes payment to be made, then yes, absolutely, 1C could potentially apply and they could charge us with 1C and we could have a hearing on 1C. That's not what happened. Again, we're talking about our internal records. They didn't even know they existed. They didn't know our timesheets didn't have an AM or PM on them at the time they issued payment. They were not the cause of the payment. The payments were not made because there was no AM and PM. And
well, don't the rules require accurate timesheets be kept by the personal care assistant?
Of course they do. And the statutes also provide a remedy when that is violated. And the remedy is a fine.
Mr. Watkins, if I can jump in here, because you know I'm focused on what the meaning of abuse is. It seems to me that that's part of your argument. And I turn to the rules to determine what abuse means. And it seems that according to the Minnesota rules, the definition of abuse says the following practices are deemed to be abuse. And that includes submitting or causing claims to be submitted from which required information is missing or incorrect. It seems that you're conceding there was some missing information that's required.
I apologize.
Well, you just did, but I guess I'd like you to elaborate on that, because it seemed to me earlier you weren't contesting that the care plans didn't have an end date. It seemed like you admitted that.
So
or concede that point.
Right. And those are distinct points, and they're important to keep distinct. They were not submissions for repayments. There was nothing that was submitted for repayment that was incomplete. Every sheet of paper that was submitted for claims for repayment was 100% complete and 100% accurate, and there's no factual dispute about that. Again, there's a difference between what we do for payment, the records and the claims that we submit for payment. DHS has an entirely different system where we go in and we submit information for payment. Nothing in this case pertains to those documents or those claims or those submissions. Nothing.
But if those submissions are based on information that can't be verified by virtue of incorrect timesheets, wouldn't you agree that that would satisfy the subpart 2.1 definition of abuse?
No, absolutely not. Because again, you're talking about, is any error in paperwork? does that does not mean you can't verify the services weren't provided. Again, in this case, we know the services were provided. There's no debate that the services were provided. There's no debate that the services were reasonably, appropriately, and accurately provided. There's simply no debate about that.
Well, because somebody doesn't have an email. Counsel, just briefly, for Ms. B, it's my understanding that there was a determination that services weren't being provided.
There was a determination for $3,700. That's it. There's an overpayment of $328,000 plus $5,000. They are very different things. So for the $3,700, there's an allegation that those services were not provided. But that's the extent of it. The only question of any services provided relates to $3,700. The $328,000, the balance of that, to the $325,000 plus the $5,000 fine, it is agreed in the record and admitted by DHS that those services were provided. They were reasonable, medically necessary, and appropriately provided. There's no debate that the billings for those services were 100% complete, 100% accurate. There's no debate about that. There's no.
Well, counsel, just going back to Judge Bryan's point and Judge Gaetis's point, the definition of abuse includes submitting repeated claims from which required information is missing or incorrect. Yeah. And the document attached to the notice and order for hearing, for each overpayment, it lists the information that was missing or incorrect. So could you address that, please?
Yeah. Again, those issues are different. They're saying our internal records were incomplete. They're not saying, and they've never alleged, and the testimony was clear, that the billing process was not incomplete. The billing
process. So you're saying you don't have to follow the rules that require that you have this information in order to be paid?
No, what I'm saying is people should follow the law. And the law is clear. If we don't have that information, if our internal records are wrong, if our internal records are incomplete, if our internal records are inaccurate, we are subject to a fine. And if we do it twice, we are subject to a greater fine. That is how the law reads. I'm saying that's the appropriate sanction. So if you find our records are incomplete or inaccurate, the law clearly tells you how to deal with that. And I want to make just one point very quickly. The abuse definition specifically starts with, which is entirely ignored by counsel, but it starts with the fact that if this gives rise to medical services that are inappropriate, that gives rise to reimbursement for services that are not medically necessary or that fail to meet professionally recognized standards for healthcare. To qualify as abuse in the regulation definition itself, it must mean that services are provided that are not medically necessary or that do not meet the standard. There is no evidence. There is no finding. And lastly, just 3 seconds. There's nothing in this record the argument by counsel is DHS has the discretion to make this decision. There's no evidence in the record that they made it. There's no evidence in the record of how they made it, what facts they consider, what evidence they consider. There's absolutely nothing. So even if you find they have the discretion to circumvent the plain language of the statute, there is nothing. There's concededly nothing in the record that explains how they exercise that discretion. That reason alone is sufficient to overturn. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. We will next hear from counsel for respondent. You have 15 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm Drew Bredesen, representing respondent, the Minnesota Department of Human Services. In this case, DHS did exactly what the legislature authorized it to do. It found services that should not have been paid for and is using the statutorily provided tool of monetary recovery to return those funds to the program from which they should not have been paid out. DHS administers the Personal Care Assistance Program, which is a pay first, audit later system. DHS paid Relator on its claims or bills, as DHS must pay the providers enrolled in the program, and also conducted post-payment reviews as the legislature requires. For its part, Relator was obligated as a provider to comply with the laws in order to be entitled to payments under the program. DHS's post-payment review in this case discovered that services that Relator was paid for had not met those prerequisites and hadn't qualified for
reimbursement. Mr. Bredesen, can I, you know, our time is brief, so if you'll indulge me and pardon the interruption, but I'd like to start kind of in your argument where we left off. As I look at the definition of abuse, there are a couple of those subdivisions that that seem more pertinent to me. I'm wondering which of those subdivisions do you think is the one we should look at, or maybe there's multiple. That 2A1, 2A7, failing to develop and maintain records as required under 9505.2175, which of course is the provision that talks about what are the required standards for records, including dates and whatnot. So what Mr. Watkins is referring to as a paperwork error, it seems to me, without addressing the specifics in this case, staying on what the law says, it seems to me that what he's calling a paperwork error is the type of thing that's listed under 9505.2175 subpart 2, which, if I'm reading the definition of abuse correctly, seems to fall under what's contemplated as abuse. So maybe you can respond to that or explain and connect the dots there between the errors in this case and the definition of abuse.
Certainly. So yes, that's certainly correct. Subpart 2A, talking about abuse, has those subdivisions, and each of these bases is relevant. So those being one, submitting claims from which required information is missing or incorrect, submitting claims failing to develop and maintain health service records as required, as you mentioned, is part seven, and submitting claims that are not reimbursable under the programs, which is three. Those are the primary three to look at. And while we're looking at subpart two, it's important to note that the definition of abuse also is discussing the fact that abuse includes acts that are inconsistent with health service practices, and then defines that it is not compliance with recognized standards for health service to do these three things. So yes, all along, DHS's concern here has been abuse and the effect of this being services that were provided that are not compliant with health service practices. And so, yes, the acts that were proved below, and it's undisputed of what was proved below, meet these definitions of abuse in the rule. And that also ties into what this court previously found in that one best case. The statute and the rule should be read together to give full effect to the provisions in both. And so this definition of abuse does entitle DHS to recover monetarily. Speaking of monetary recovery, DHS plainly gave notice of the overpayment recovery.
So before you move on, I'd just like to drill down a little more on Judge Bryan's question. You identified three provisions, A1, A7, and I believe A3. And counsel for appellant argues that A1 doesn't apply because the forms that they submitted for payment were accurate. And he is arguing that the information that is identified in the attachment to the notice and order for hearing wasn't on the forms that were submitted for payment. So can you address, and I understand that those forms, or that the information that was missing is required to be, much of it's required by 9505.275, but can you address his argument relating to A1 and whether that is applicable?
Sure, certainly. So the one thing that I'd like to touch on as we get into this question is the fact that the rule does require that you have, the statutes and rules require that you have care plans in order for services to be eligible for payment. The rules and statutes require that you have to have accurate timesheets, accurate health records. In fact, the timesheet rule specifically says as a condition of payment, you have to have accurate timesheets. So it is perfectly accurate that when payments are being requested based on these services, lacking the required information from, there's information that is required for these services to be eligible for payment. And it is undisputed that the information that the relator was required to keep was not there, that information was missing or incorrect. And so that does constitute abuse. And regarding the notice of that, this is laid out quite clearly in the notices. DHS sent relator notices saying that it would seek overpayment recovery and stating the reasons for that. The notices cite 2064 and the rules 2165 explaining authority for overpayment recovery, including abuse, rules explaining what conduct constitutes abuse, and then includes about 200 pages itemizing the violations at issue, the basis for which DHS sought overpayment recovery. And the language there mirrors what you see in 2165. So this is certainly reasonably calculated to apprise relator of the action, the scope, the stakes, the amount, the basis of recovery.
Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Thank you. Was the notice sufficient where it didn't specifically identify abuse as a grounds for recovery?
The notice was sufficient, and it did identify abuse as the grounds of recovery by directing, by stating the language from these rules, by directing the recipient to these rules, by using the language from the statute that talks about these rules. And notably, it's interesting that we're now hearing that there is claims of surprise, because yes, a witness did talk about this at the hearing. If you look at the transcript, it is in the transcript that Ms. Steffens testified explicitly reading the language of this of the relevant rules regarding monetary recovery explicitly. And on top of that, there was no motion practice in this case that challenged the basis of DHS to recover on any of these grounds. And yes, throughout the case, there has never been a question that monetary recovery of overpaid funds was the issue based on abuse. That notice was there.
Mr. Bredesen, Mr. Watkins has expressed concern both in his brief and during his argument this morning about, I'll call it disparity in treatment of similar violations in Ms. B's violations and the violations that were sanctioned. Both concern deficiencies in the care plan records. And I'm just wondering what your response to that argument is, that the decision is arguably arbitrary and capricious because there's no justification for the way those different types of violations were treated.
Certainly. So I think it's notable to begin that the grounds for sanctions include abuse. And abuse was, again, one of the issues that, through those definitions, was at issue underlying the sanction, that fine. So the abuse chain has been here all along, underlying the basis for the fine, which was never disputed. Regarding the different treatment here, these are the facts that are relevant. The legislature gave DHS two tools to use. One of those is overpayment recovery. One of those is sanctioning. In this case, it was undisputed that there for years was no care plan. This is the necessary document that guides services for this recipient. No care plan in place. The only one that was ever produced was invalid at the get-go, and there was never one there to replace it. Throughout this time, never a care plan. That fact is abuse, and that authorizes DHS to recover authorizes DHS to conduct monetary recovery. DHS also was entitled, it had the authority to recover monetarily for the other care plan violations. And there DHS used leniency, it used its judgment to not seek overpayment recovery. And that those facts are also testified quite clearly to.
Mr. Bredesen, it sounds like, again, without addressing the specifics of this case, just looking at what the authority is, sounds like you're arguing that DHS can use either tool.
Correct.
And that DHS they're not mutually exclusive. And is there any guidance as to when or under what circumstances they would exercise judgment to, or as you put it, leniency, to use one tool instead of the other?
The legislature gives both tools. It says DHS may impose a sanction and it may seek monetary recovery. If choosing to impose a sanction, it must conduct that nature, chronicity, and severity analysis. If it may use the tool of monetary recovery, that permission is right there. And it has the legal basis of when it is authorized to do so. But the guidance that comes from that results from exactly what happened in this case. So DHS had, I shouldn't say results from, but is demonstrated by what happened in this case. The argument being, if DHS has no ability to decide whether to impose monetary recovery, that means that the conduct that was subject to a fine should have been subject to monetary recovery. That means that DHS, if DHS must obtain monetary recovery, then that means that it should have recovered the fine, the funds that were paid where a fine was just issued. And instead, what DHS did was recognize that these were exceptional forms that were used, nonetheless incomplete, that the records were still deficient, but DHS elected in that case to recognize the high quality of what could adequately guide care if properly executed, and decided in that instance that it wasn't appropriate to seek monetary recovery. There was no such facts suggesting leniency for the EB investigation, for Ms. B's situation. Again, this is years where there was no care plan in place, no valid care plan ever approved. And so this is the instance that the legislature specifically contemplated by giving DHS both tools. It may impose monetary recovery and it may not in its judgment of executing services. Part of this does come from 256B 04. One of the things that DHS is tasked with is appropriate utilization of funds from the program. And that is, for instance, one of the things that DHS can consider. And yes, so there is guidance that exists. The final point here is to just emphasize the difference between overpayment recovery and fines. Again, these are separate tools. Monetary recovery is just that. It is recovering funds back to the program that should not have paid out. And that could be for many reasons that we've discussed, but the thing that is very important for us to recognize is that the payment was issued on the assumption that the provider was complying with the prerequisites for payment. The opposite was found to be true. So DHS did pay and then found out that it should not have paid. The payments were improper based on the fact that the prerequisites for payment were violated. There was not that compliance. And so, yes, this is certainly a case where payments were made as a result of abuse, and those funds are properly returned to the program as contemplated by the legislature and by the law. And it's also expressly consistent. Sorry, Judge, go ahead.
How does Rules 9505.2215 that talks about monetary recovery play into the discretion that you were talking about with regard to the instances where the department decided to impose a fine rather than seek monetary recovery?
Sure, Your Honor, that is a difficult question. The rule there does provide that the commissioner shall seek monetary recovery from a vendor if a payment under a program was a result of fraud, theft, abuse, or error on the part of the vendor, department, or local agency. That is what that rule authorizes. Here, to reconcile that rule with the statute is to give what the statute is explicit about, and that is the permissive authority for DHS to seek monetary recovery. And these are circumstances where, as stated in 2215, the department should seek monetary recovery. And if there's a variance to be taken from DHS's conduct, that would be that DHS, if reading that rules the way that Relator suggests this should be, that would require that DHS recover the overpayments from the agency investigation, where instead it elected to only impose a fine. So in short, Your Honor, the respondent respectfully requests that the commissioner's order be affirmed. And if there are no further questions, I yield my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bredesen. And now we will go back to Mr. Watkins for rebuttal.
You may thank begin. You. I appreciate that. So just to be very clear, looking at the statute section 2F, there's a explicit provision that says the failure to fully document services according to the standards of chapter 9505. If that happens, if there is any failure to document services or fees, the statute specifically limits the amount that can be fined to 5,000 or 20% of the claims at issue, whichever is less. They acknowledge that. They agree that there is an explicit statutory limit. If this court were to agree that you can define abuse so broadly as to include any paperwork error, no matter how innocuous or innocent, that becomes superfluous and meaningless. There's no meaning in that section whatsoever. If you can recover as much as you want, there's no purpose and a limitation on the recovery. Similarly, Section 1F, Subdivision 1, Section 7, I apologize, Subdivision 1A, 7, also says if you want to go to a more harsh sanction, you have to wait, you have to give them an opportunity to cure the paperwork errors. Then and only then, if they fail to cure, can you go to a more harsh sanction. To rule as counsel argues, abuse includes any paperwork error, you'd have to render Subdivision 1A7 meaningless. You'd have to strike that as well. The rule itself specifically defines abuse, and it says any failure to include any action has to also result in unnecessary cost to the program or reimbursement for services that are
Mr. Watkins,
yes.
The statutory, the $5,000 limit, is that a may or a must in the statute?
That's a may limit. It may impose the fine, but if it imposes a fine, it must limit it to $5,000. So the fine is optional. The limit is not. And then as I was saying, thank you for that, because that's important. And then one, and this is, again, in the definition that DHS adopted for fraud, it specifically says that for it to be abuse, it must result in unnecessary cost to the program or reimbursement for services that are not medically necessary or that fail to meet professionally recognized standards. There's no allegation that any of that happened in this case. But
do you agree that DHS has those two tools available to it for the same conduct? Or do you think those are mutually exclusive tools?
I think they have to be read as mutually exclusive, or the statute has no meaning. Those limitations are of absolutely no meaning if you can say, well, we've got the option of limiting it to 5,000 or not limiting it to 5,000. That has no meaning. And case law is very clear not to interpret statutory frameworks such as to render entire subdivisions meaningless. It's the exact same conduct. Counsel has argued the exact same conduct entitles him to collect 20% as a fine and 80% as an overpayment. The statute limits 20% to the fine. For that to have meaning, it has to actually have an effect. And the argument here is it doesn't have an effect. I also want to switch very quickly to the other crucial argument. Counsel's entire position is we have the discretion. We have the discretion to do whatever we want. Despite the statutory limitation, we have the discretion to impose a fine or go collect the other 80% elsewhere. Even if you were to accept everything he has said, all of his arguments, there's still a huge fundamental problem in this case. There's nothing in the record that supports that decision. You've asked a lot of questions about guidance, factors, what was considered, what wasn't considered. The only witness they put up conceded she had no idea whatsoever how the decision was made, what factors were considered, why the decision was made. DHS does audits every year, every quarter of every healthcare provider. It has never conducted an audit in which it's found zero paperwork errors. That just hasn't happened. The question is, why in this case are you imposing, even if you have this discretion, at most it's discretionary. 1A is a may statute. At most it's discretionary, as counsel argues. Nothing in the record that says we decided to call it abuse. Nothing in the record to explain how they made that decision, why they made that decision, what factors they considered. The statute, as counsel agreed, specifically says they should consider the nature, severity, chronicity, and the impact on services provided. Those were not considered. Nothing was considered. There's no evidence. Again, case law is abundantly clear. If they don't explain the basis for exercising their discretion, how and why they chose to do what they did, that's an abuse of discretion. That's arbitrary and capricious all day long. So even if they had this incredible discretion to overcome statutory limits imposed by the legislature, to rewrite the word abuse, to scratch out its own definition and defy common sense, you still have to explain how you've exercised that discretion in a reasoned and reasonable way, particularly given the extreme severity of the sanction here. This is an incredible sanction, vastly 66 times greater than what the statute calls for. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and